Thank you. So once again, welcome and happy Halloween. Glad we could all come in costumes tonight. And I trust that you weathered the storm, and I hope it wasn't too difficult. I know some lost power, not as many as in other times and in other parts of the East Coast. And just to acknowledge those who have suffered, there have been some significant loss of life and a lot of other suffering as well, of property and people, a lot of hardship, and just kind of holding all who are going through difficulties in our hearts this evening. The theme of the talk tonight is finding peace amid storms and elections. Insights of the Buddha and neuroscience. So what I want to talk about this evening, ways in which the Buddha spoke of 2,500 years ago about how we can work with whatever it is that's coming up. You know, I don't think they had a lot of elections in his day, but they certainly had storms and other trials and tribulations. And this practice is appropriate and highly beneficial for working with whatever the joys and the sorrows and the pains and the pleasures are that that arise. I just a quick check-in. Do any of you feel that you kind of were stressed out or anxious about around the storm and where it might lead or how it might unfold? Anybody experience that? Yeah, very much. Anybody feel that you took in a lot of information, kind of watching TV or listening to radio? Like, where's it coming? Is it coming here? What's going on over there? And my own experience was, I mean, I don't tend to get kind of overly, you know, kind of worried or freaked out. But one of my causes of, sometimes it can cause anxiety, is I tend to kind of take in a lot of information. And so what I found myself the day after the storm feeling kind of really quite tight and negative and, you know, kind of funky, not feeling good, and, you know, mind state didn't feel very positive. I didn't feel I had a lot of energy to do things or kind of a lot of aspiration. And I paid attention to it, and I realized that I'd really had watched too much TV and kind of got really caught up in the information and some level of anxiety that comes out of that when people, oh, what's going to happen? Look what's happening here. So one of the things that I did was I just took like 15 minutes and I lay down. And I just kind of relaxed and, you know, was if I'd have gone to sleep, that would have been okay, but it was kind of in between state. But what I was able to do was just kind of recalibrate the nervous system, just kind of almost like rebooting the computer, you know, kind of. And that was really, really helpful. And it's a way... you know, that's just one way in which this practice of just, firstly, we have to be aware that there's something amiss. You know, in the Buddha's teaching is the first noble truth, the truth of suffering. We have to recognize that there's something, that there's suffering or stress before we even feel interested or inclined to do anything about it. So really helpful, this practice of awareness, say, oh, I'm feeling tight, I'm feeling tense. I mean, maybe right now, some of us may still have some residue from that. You know, the other big thing that's going on right now, some of you might have noticed, is there's an election going on. 6 days or whatever away. And does anyone feel that you're watching more TV or radio, listening to more radio than you maybe would feel is helpful or healthy? Any of you here feel, I'm not going to get into the content, so don't be nervous about kind of like, oh, is he going to say you should vote this or that? Obviously not going to do that, but more just kind of the way in which we can involve ourselves in the conditions of the world. Do any of you find yourself worried or anxious about how they might turn out? like, you know, oh, if this candidate wins or this party wins, what are the next 4 years going to be like? Does anyone find you're taking in too much information and getting stressed out by that? Seems like some... who feels like you're listening to or watching people, only those people who you agree with? You know, it's one of the things right now that, you know, we tend to kind of listen and watch and read the things that somehow reinforce our own opinions. I mean, I know that's the case with me, you know, and it's something I bring awareness to, but, you know, something like I don't agree with that position, I'm less likely to kind of read it or listen to it. Does anyone find yourself getting angry or judgmental towards those who have different views from you? Maybe a candidate that you disagree with, or some an opinion, you know, a pundit or whatever you disagree with. So, who said no to all of those? Maybe one or two people, but we, you know, it's one of these areas where we can get really sucked in. And if the answer is yes to any of these questions, then it's really a good signal that bringing mindfulness to how you're engaging in this process might be a very helpful thing, might help ease stress and suffering. I'm not suggesting to be disengaged or to not be interested, because that can be just another form of aversion, you know, of like, oh, you switch off altogether. Personally, I think it's a very good thing to care about our world, and to care about the, you know, the political process and about policies and decisions that affect all our lives. But we can get involved in these things and everything else in ways that that are not helpful to us, that are not healthy for us. The political process, elections, storms, other events are really areas to bring awareness to and explore, how am I holding this? What's my relationship to what's happening? Whatever the circumstances or the conditions are, you know, whatever's going on, whatever our experience is, we have the capacity to choose between peace and suffering, between happiness and well-being on one side and stress or anxiety on the other side. That poem that that I read during the meditation, or quoted in the meditation, from Dorothy Hunt: peace is this moment without judgment, this moment in the heart space where everything that is welcome. It's this understanding that in each moment we can choose peace, happiness, or freedom, or we can choose stress, anxiety, suffering. We don't often acknowledge that, or even necessarily realize that it's a choice. But insofar as we're caught up in our views and opinions, the things that we want, the things that we don't want, we are in fact making a choice. Each time we act out a habit, even though we don't necessarily examine it, then we're actually making a choice. The choice really is, in any moment, is being aware or being unaware. And if we're aware, that's really a gateway to happiness, to peace, to freedom. And if we're unaware, then it's really a gateway to continued stress and suffering. I think realizing this possibility, realizing that we do have a choice in every moment of our lives, is one of the most important steps on the spiritual path. Because if we don't have that realization, then there's not really an understanding that freedom is essentially within our own hands, in our own hands. That happiness is in our hands. And that's one of the great realizations of the Buddha's teachings, that we actually can choose whether to be happy, to be peaceful, to be free, or to choose suffering, stress, anxiety, unhappiness. The latter we don't think of as choosing, but it is actually, as I said, it is actually a choice. It's kind of a default choice. If we're not being present, we're being somewhere else. So really, this step, this choice is really a simple shift from being identified with our experience, being caught up in it on one hand, or being aware of it on the other. A shift from automatic or habitual responses to experience, or to actually being aware of experience. So it's really the choice or the difference between being caught up in a strong emotion. Let's say we're caught up in anger and we get identified with a story in our own mind. How could he do that? How could she say that? I'm going to give him a piece of my mind. And we're actually kind of swept up in it. You know, a kind of an extreme example of this would be road rage, where somebody is so caught up in their anger that they do something really violent and kind of act out the rage. So just being caught up in a strong emotion or a strong mind state on one hand, and on the other, being aware of the energy of the emotion, bringing attention, bringing awareness to the thoughts that are present and the bodily experiences that are present, but having enough space to step back from it. This is one of the most important distinctions in the world, because once, if we're caught up, then we're just acting things out over and over again. We're acting out habits, we're acting out patterns, we're acting out conditions. But with awareness, whatever the energy is, whatever the emotion is, if we can bring awareness to it, then we're already on the path to freedom. Freedom from that emotion, freedom from that mind state, because we're no longer caught up in it. I think of it, an image that I find helpful is like riding a wild horse. You know, when we're riding a wild horse, where do we go? Well, we go wherever the wild horse goes. There's a kind of the story of somebody galloping past on a horse, and somebody shouts out, "Where are you going?" And the rider says, "Don't ask me, ask the horse." And this is really kind of when we're swept away, when we're carried away by a strong emotion or mind state. It's like we're carried by that energy. We're no longer, as it were, in the driver's seat. The horse, the energy is in the driver's seat. The difference between this and the difference between riding a horse where we're, you know, the horse is trained, where it's going essentially where we want it to go. We can, you know, help pull the reins and it goes to the right or goes to the left. This is really the essence of the Buddha's teachings, that we can cultivate and develop peace, happiness, freedom, and that we can find a way out of stress and suffering. That our freedom, our peace of mind, comes from and really depends on training our mind. This is really kind of the core of the Buddha's teachings, that we can train our minds. Here's a quote from the Buddha. "I know of no other single thing so conducive to misery as this uncultivated, untrained mind. I know of no other single thing so conducive to well-being as this cultivated and well-trained mind." So the difference between a trained mind and an untrained mind is the difference between freedom and suffering. All of the harm and the violence that we see around us and we see in history really comes from an untrained mind, untrained minds. It comes from people acting out, you know, this is what I'm feeling, this is what I'm believing, and therefore I've got to do this. You know, out of that we turn people into enemies, you know, there's killing and there's violence, there's greed, because there's not awareness. There's not awareness of our own experience, there's not awareness of our interconnectedness with others, there's not awareness of this whole web of life that we've got caught up in a very limited, partial view, an illusion essentially, and then anything is possible. As the Buddha says, with an untrained mind, anything is possible. All the harm and all the suffering in the world can come from a mind that's not trained. So the great realization of the Buddha is that we all have the capacity to live a completely free life. You know, this sometimes it's called our Buddha nature. This capacity that each one of us has, not just an elite, not just kind of special people, not just the Buddha, but each one of us has this capacity to wake up, to be free of suffering. The great Thai teacher, Ajahn Chah, lived in the kind of the 20th century, late 20th century, he said, if you let go a little, you'll find a little peace. If you let go a lot, you'll find a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you'll experience complete peace, complete freedom. Your struggle with the world will be at an end. I like that last line. Because so much of our lives, you know, we experience as like a struggle with the world. Kind of get things the way we want them to, get rid of the things we don't like, get more of the things we like. It seems like you have a field going through life that kind of feels like a struggle with the world, the struggle with other people, struggle with other situations. And yet there's this capacity to live a free life. And we can, you know, we don't necessarily all have to believe that we're going to become Buddhas in this lifetime, but I think all of us are here, all of us are, you know, have taken some steps on this path, or spiritual path, because we see some level of freedom is possible, or greater freedom, less stress, less suffering in our lives is possible. So the Buddha taught there is a path of training, of practice, to help us find freedom from suffering. What's really been interesting in the last, particularly the last 20 or 30 years, is that increasingly studies in neuroscience, studies of our brains, Philip Moffitt, who would have been here, he talks about it as the coconut, studies of the coconut, of our brains, and how they've evolved and how they operate, are coming now to very similar understandings about the fact that we can train up our minds, that we can change our brains, physically change our brains, and I'll talk about that this evening, and that we can experience much greater freedom and peace in our lives. There is this kind of convergence, or you know, the Buddhist teachings have been saying it for 2,500 years, but the scientific studies of the brain and the nervous system are coming to very, very similar understandings, very similar conclusions. And I'll talk about that those this evening, that we can train our minds, that we can change our brains, and that this training can lessen stress and anxiety and can increase happiness and well-being. Here's how a wonderful current Tibetan teacher, Mingyur Rinpoche, put it. I love this quote. He says, ultimately, happiness comes down to choosing between the discomfort of becoming aware of your mental afflictions and the discomfort of being ruled by them. I'll read that again. Ultimately, happiness comes down to choosing between two kinds of discomfort: the discomfort of becoming aware of your mental afflictions and the discomfort of being ruled by them. And that's really the difference I was talking about before. It's uncomfortable when we're ruled by our mental afflictions, when we're carried away by our anger or our judgments or our aversions. That's uncomfortable. It's experienced as stress and suffering. It's in the Pali language, dukkha, or suffering, when we're caught up in that. But there's that suffering. And then there's the discomfort of being aware of them. It's still uncomfortable because we're bringing awareness to something that's unpleasant and difficult. But the difference is that the first one, we just keep acting out the habits over and over again, and there's no release from the suffering. But with the second, when we bring awareness to the afflictive states, there's a way out of the suffering. We actually come to see that we don't have to be trapped in it or caught up in it, that it's actually an impermanent experience. It's a selfless experience. If we don't cling, if we don't hold on, everything comes and goes. And there's a way out of suffering. It's a tremendously important realization on this path to see that however strong the emotions are, the mind states are, the afflictive states are, that if we can bring awareness to them, we can find freedom from them and within them. Eckhart Tolle says, everything we accept, we go beyond. Everything we accept, we go beyond. And that's why we talk, you know, a great deal, you know, in the meditation instructions and in the talks about welcoming. Tara Brach talks about radical acceptance, the name of a book. Radically, deeply accepting what is here, accepting this moment as it is. Another spiritual teacher, Byron Katie, uses the phrase in one of her books, loving what is. Loving what is. Opening to our experience as it is. You know, we don't have to like what is, but loving what is really welcoming, opening to, accepting this moment as it is. So in Mingpa Rinpoche, the quote from the Tibetan teacher Mingpa Rinpoche, he uses the word choosing. Choosing between the two kinds of discomfort. And I think the word choosing is important because we often don't take our state of mind as a choice or how we meet our state of mind or emotions as a choice, but more as a given. It's just how it is. And we kind of act it out quite often. But in any moment, as I've said, in any experience, we can choose to meet this moment with awareness or with lack of awareness. And the former will lead to happiness and to well-being, and the latter will lead to continued stress and suffering. So in any moment we can ask, how am I choosing to meet this moment? This one right now. You know, just aware of, as you're sitting here, as you're listening, as I'm speaking, I kind of feel tightness in my belly and in my chest, just kind of feeling, nice to be here. And whatever you're feeling is what's here. And the choice is, how am I meeting this moment? What am I aware of? And can I be with this moment as it is? Am I opening to this experience and accepting it, saying yes to the truth of this moment? Or am I in some way resisting, checking out, you know, identifying with it? Here's how the Buddha understood the mind and its capacity for freedom. He spoke about the mind being luminous. He said, luminous is this mind, brightly shining, but it is colored by the attachments that visit it. This, unlearned people who are not practicing, do not really understand, and so they don't cultivate the mind. Luminous is this mind, brightly shining, and it's free from the attachments that visit it. This, the noble follower of the way, really understands. So for them, there is cultivation of the mind. So these kind of two alternatives the Buddha often gives. The first is that in each case, the mind is spacious, open, free. But in the first case, the mind isn't trained. And so we get caught up in attachments. We see things that aren't really the way they are, but we identify with them. It's like an image I have of somebody who's on a journey and trying to get somewhere, and really with their eye on the prize of where they're going. But all along the way, people are shaking shiny objects and gold baubles and saying, no, try this, come over here. This is much more interesting. This is, don't forget about your journey. You know, enjoy this. And we get caught up in these attachments. We get caught up in these illusions, really. We think this is going to provide, if I only have more of this. If I only have this kind of security. If only I had a relationship. If only I had more money. If only this difficult person were out of my life. If only I had a different president. You know, I mean, all of this kind of wanting things to be other than they are. When we're caught up in that, we're as Tara would talk about, we're taking false refuge. And we're forgetting about the true refuge, which is in awareness, which is in our basic being present with what is. So the Buddha's path of training is a path to freedom from suffering, called the Noble Eightfold Path, and it includes, you know, training in cultivating, living wisely, living compassionately, training the mind to see things as they really are, and cultivating wisdom. And a key element of this path that we talk about a great deal is the practice of mindfulness. Mindfulness really is the way, you know, the way out of suffering. If we can bring awareness to what's present in the body, to whatever emotions are present, whatever mind states are present, whatever thoughts are present, just a non-judging awareness, a kind and compassionate awareness to our experience as it is, then what arises naturally is insight, awareness that is liberating, that allows us to see that nothing can be held on to, and that when we try to hold on to anything, when we grasp, when we cling, then we suffer. So the Buddha taught that freedom is really not dependent on the conditions of our life. We might have really difficult or painful conditions, but much more dependent on how we meet those conditions, how we meet the circumstances of our lives. Great quote from Viktor Frankl in Man's Search for Meaning, where he says, you know, talking about even in the concentration camps, it was possible he said they could take everything from us, but the last of the human freedoms, the freedom to determine how we respond to our conditions. They could take everything else away, but not that freedom, the freedom of how we meet our experience. And that's really the essence of the Buddha's teachings too, that our happiness and our peace depends on how we choose to meet with whatever conditions, external conditions, the things that happen to us, the joys and the sorrows, the losses, the happiness, all of the, what the Taoists call the 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows, how we meet that experience. That's what determines our happiness and our well-being. So I want to talk for a few minutes, or kind of focus in the rest of the talk on what the science is showing and how that is meeting together with these ancient wisdom teachings of the Buddha and other traditions as well that are pointing into the same truths, that our freedom and our happiness is in our own hands. So the studies of the brain, neuroscience, is confirming the Buddha's understandings of the mind and the capacity we have to train the mind and to, in fact, change our brains. One of the understandings that have come in the last 30 years or so is that our brains change throughout our lives, and what we do and how we use our attention can bring about important changes in our brains. This is called, as you probably know, neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity, that is the kind of the changeability, the malleability of these brains. It used to be thought that once we reached adulthood, the brain was essentially kind of stopped there. It developed during childhood, adolescence, but then it stopped. But the studies have found that the brain is changing throughout our lives. There have been some really interesting studies of how our brains change with the activities we engage in. So they've done studies of London taxi drivers. You know, they have to learn the mazes of, I think, 30,000 streets in London in order to pass an exam and train, study for 3 years. And they've found that the London cab drivers' brains are thicker in areas that are key to visual spatial memory. So that part of the brain gets highly developed through the activity of learning, okay, this is the Brompton Road and this is how you get to the Bayswater Road or whatever it is. Also, they've studied musicians. The brains of pianists are thicker in areas of fine motor functions. You know, imagine a pianist or a violinist and how the activities of the hand and how the brains are changed through the training in fine motor functions. They found that the brains of meditators are thicker in regions engaged with sensory awareness and control of attention. There's been a number of fascinating recent studies of one in the last year or two is where they found that the structure of the brains of participants in an 8-week mindfulness training program, the brains changed with an average of just 27 minutes of meditation a day. So physically the brain changed. The brains of the meditators showed an increasing gray matter density in areas of the brain associated with memory, with self-awareness, with compassion, and with introspection. So the area, the brain itself thickened in those areas, and that's a good thing, to thicken in those areas. And there was a decrease in density of gray matter in areas associated with stress and anxiety. So in just an 8-week period, in less than half an hour of practice a day, physical changes in the brains of meditators. Now, they'd found this in Tibetan Buddhist monks who had 10,000 hours of meditation. It's the kind of the Olympic athletes of the meditation world. And you could say, oh, not such a big surprise if you're going to do that much meditation. You know, it'll change your brain and probably your bum as well from sitting on the cushion all that time. But with just in 8 weeks and less than half an hour a day, the brains of meditators practitioners changed. So the brain is plastic, it's changing. And one of the reasons why it's good that our brains can change is that we've inherited these brains through evolution. These brains, I assume most people here believe in evolution. And anyway, if you don't, that's fine too. But I'm going to posit that our brains have developed over millions of years through evolution, and that we actually have this three-part, not my theory obviously, but this three-part brain that's part reptilian, part old mammal brain, and part new mammal brain. And that this changed, I won't go into too much of detail around it tonight just for reasons of time. But I will refer you to a wonderful book by Rick Hansen, some of you may know, called Buddha's Brain. Very, very interesting on this whole question of Buddhism, Buddhist teachings, and neuroscience, and kind of the convergence between them. But one of the things, you know, he and others, neuroscientists and psychologists, are saying that we've inherited these brains through evolution that obviously can do marvelous things, you know, that can invent, you know, wonderful poetry and build incredible buildings and wonders of the world. But the brain also gets us in trouble. You may have seen it with your own model. And one of the reasons for this is that our brain has a negative bias. Here's why. Our ancestors evolved, both kind of from the reptilian to the mammalian to our human ancestors. We evolved in dangerous neighborhoods. And in order to survive, our ancestors, you know, both our animal ancestors and human ancestors, had to be really on the lookout for what was negative. You know, it was at a premium. You know, I just imagine a scenario, a cartoon of a couple of people on the Serengeti plain, you know, 100,000 years ago or whatever, and there's a sound coming out of, you know, from a distance away, you know. There may be two people, you know, there. The one who took that as a message of like, uh-oh, this could be trouble, and ran away as fast as they could, was more likely to pass on their genes than the one that, you know, continued to chill out and, oh, it's probably nothing, you know, and then the tiger jumps out on them. So our brains, you know, were really selected for vigilance, for being on the lookout for the negative, much more than being on the lookout for the positive. You know, as Rick Hansen puts it in his book, if we didn't get the meal or the opportunity to mate, well, maybe that'll come tomorrow or next week or next year, with this time for that. But if we, you know, if we didn't respond to the threat to our survival in real time, then we wouldn't have a chance to tomorrow, next day, to have the meal or the opportunity to mate. So our brains, really, the brains we've inherited, are really primed for the negative. Here are some examples of that. As Rick Hansen puts it, he says, it's the negative experience, not the positive ones, that have generally had the most impact on our survival. So some of the ways that our brains get us in trouble is, firstly, this bias towards the negative. Some examples: bad emotions, bad parents, bad feedback have more impact than good parents, emotions, and feedback. You know, we're much more likely to be affected by negative experiences in those areas. And bad information, negative information, is processed more thoroughly than good information. Negative information weighs more heavily on the brain. The brain typically detects negative information faster than it detects positive information. Again, it's like we're on the lookout. The brain we've inherited through evolution is on the lookout for the negative, and the processes much more quickly the negative information than the positive information. For example, fearful faces are perceived much more quickly than happy or neutral ones. If we see a scary face, we're aware of that more quickly than a happy, smiling face or a more neutral face. Negative experiences have more high priority storage. When an event is flagged as negative, a part of the brain known as the hippocampus makes sure it's stored for future reference, which isn't the same as with positive information. So the negative, we have this ways of remembering, ways of processing more quickly the negative information. The way Hansen puts it, he says, your brain is like Velcro for negative experiences and Teflon for positive ones. So it's like we glom onto the negative, and the positive kind of can, you know, come off us like water off a duck's back. So it's important that we cultivate the positive, that we take it in, that we nurture it, that we balance this tendency of the mind to focus on the negative. We can see this focus on the negative in the ways that we can incorporate stress into our lives. You know, we have this fight or flight mechanism, which is part of this kind of negative response. It's a great mode of the brain and the nervous system that when something is threatening, we can react immediately to it. Kind of if some vehicle's coming at us quickly, we can dive out of the way before, without having to kind of, what should I do here? Shall I, you know, there's this automatically, we'll take the steps we need to take. But because of the brains that have developed, including the reptilian and the old mammal brain and this neocortex, this developed brain, because of this, the brain we've inherited and this negative focus of the brain, we can respond to stressful events, you know, at something like, you know, your boss at work says, oh, I need that report in by Friday, as opposed to a week or two hence. And we can respond in the same way to that as we do to a bear ready to jump out on us. We go through the same mind-body responses. And because of the, you know, the ability to kind of be rational and reflect, we can actually, that can actually be negative for us, that we can keep thinking about, oh, I've got to do this work, what's going to happen, I'm never going to do it, oh, I'm going to lose my job. And we can stay in that stressed out place. You know, it's a function of this response of the brain, but we can use it, we can respond in ways that keep us stressed out and keep us in this kind of releasing the cortisol and adrenaline, being in this fight or flight mode. And it can be really negative for our health, for our mental health, for our physical health, for our well-being. So we need a way of bringing awareness to that. And this is where mindfulness comes in. Mindfulness is really a way of stepping out of that hypervigilance, out of that fight or flight mode, and just coming back into the present moment. Just, we can be aware that we're tense, we're uptight. We can just let breathe and then relax. We can notice the thoughts that are coming up in our minds. What if this happened? What if this happened? And we can see them as thoughts that come and go, which is very, very different from when we're having the thoughts and we're treating them as though they're true. Oh, yes, I will get fired. Oh, and then what will happen? I'll lose my job, you know. And if we just let that kind of, if we're not aware of our thoughts in that way, then, you know, I like to think, you know, where we'll end up is in a ditch, naked, hungry, alone, being tortured, you know, because the mind can always create worse and worse scenarios, you know. But all we need to do is just bring awareness that this is, you know, these are thoughts, that we don't need to identify with them. Thoughts come and go. Bodily experiences come and go. So we need to balance this tendency of the brain to focus on the negative, and mindfulness can really help us break this cycle. And it really is the difference between suffering and freedom. And what the science is telling us is really what the Buddha was teaching 2,500 years ago, which is if we bring awareness to our experience, then we shift, I mean, they're coming to the same conclusion, but different language, but we're shifting awareness to parts of the brain that are focused on well-being, on peace, on happiness, and out of those areas that are focused on stress and anxiety and fear and responding to, you know, in this fearful, anxious way. I want to talk about one other study which I find really fascinating. It was done about 5 years ago. And basically what they did was they looked at the brains through functional fMRIs, functional magnetic resonance imaging, looked at the brains of non-meditators, regular folks and meditators. And they looked at what our brains do when we are not focused on a task. So if we were just regular human beings, which we are, but some of us, you know, we do this practice too, we're just folks, and you invited people to sit down for 5 or 10 minutes and not think about anything in particular, what they've found is that our brain goes into a default mode, which is basically one of chatter and distraction. They found we're doing one of four things. We're commenting on our experience. It's kind of a narrative. Oh, yeah, when I've got... kind of what's going on. It's kind of a telling a story to ourselves about what's going on. We're remembering the past, and we're imagining the future. So we're kind of time traveling away from the present moment. We're interpreting things in terms of ourselves, you know, what does this mean for me? And we're thinking of others and ourselves in relation to others. So we're in this kind of cognitive processing, you know, how am I in relation to this other person? And does she like me or does he like me? And, you know, all of this stuff, this kind of conversations we're having, we're in this narrative mode. And they found that being in this narrative mode is actually connected with suffering. It's not a pleasant place to be. It's not a happy place to be. And yet, this is a place we can spend a great deal of our time, kind of in this chatter, distraction mode. And it, It appears to have had, I mean, there's a reason why we're doing this. They call this the default state. And they speculate that it may have evolved to allow us to live in an increasingly complex world, you know, to solve problems that aren't here yet. So it's not just we're needing to deal with what's here right now. It might be, where did that tiger come from who ate Fred last week? I better steer clear of that area, that kind of that processing. And obviously there's a good function in this, but what we're doing is we're spending a lot of time in this mode. The good news, however, though, is that the brain also has another mode, which they call the experiencing mode. This is where we're actually aware of our experience right now. This is really another way of putting it is, this is being mindful of our experience in the present moment. When we're in the experiencing mode, different parts of the brain are being activated, connected with awareness of our senses, awareness of our emotions. It's like right this moment, we could be, you could be kind of thinking about, what am I going to do later this evening? What am I going to do next week? Or you could be, okay, I'm aware of my body, I'm aware of what I'm hearing, I'm taking in things, I'm here or else I'm somewhere else. And they found that it's possible to train this experiencing mode in just 8 weeks of meditation. So we can train this part of our awareness, this being present in just 8 weeks. And that, as I mentioned before, that through meditation, through the practice of mindfulness, we change the brain. It becomes thicker and new neurons are created and those areas connected with well-being and happiness are strengthened. So different parts of the brain are activated when we're in this direct experience mode. I won't go into the different parts, but what they found is that meditation seems to lead to three changes. We can recover more quickly from when we're in that distracted mode. We can catch ourselves more quickly as well. So we can kind of see, oh, there I am. I'm caught up in that story, in that narrative, and then come back more quickly. They've also found that meditators spend more time in the experiencing mode in daily life. So more time in the present moment. And when we're in this present moment awareness, we're more peaceful and we're more happy. And as I mentioned, meditation seems to strengthen areas of the brain that help create this experiential state. So these two modes, and we can experience it in meditation. You know, it's what we do when we say, okay, bring awareness to your breath or to the sounds or bodily sensations. And then notice when you're somewhere else. Notice when you're, planning what you're going to watch on TV when you get home or what you're going to do at work tomorrow or, think about what happened earlier today. And it's not a problem that we go into this mode, but it's helpful and healthy and beneficial not to spend our lives in that mode, but to actually come back and be present with our experience as it is. One of the things they found in doing studies of Buddhist meditators is they were less likely to be shocked, flustered, surprised, or as angry compared to other people. Studies also showed that meditators' brains linked to positive emotions, self-control, and temperament were constantly lit up, not just when they were meditating. So if you meditate on a regular basis, your brain will be lighting up those areas connected with positive emotions and positive experiences will be lit up even when you're not meditating. So Richie Davidson, who's one of the leading researchers in this whole area of neuroscience, he says people are not just stuck at their respective set points. We can take advantage of our brain's plasticity and train it to enhance these qualities. So this is basically saying what the Buddha has been saying, that we can train our minds, we can change our brains, that we can live more happily by cultivating this ability to be present, this quality of being here now. I want to just mention one more study because I found this one really quite a fun one. This is how they found that Buddhist meditators, and meditators in general, I think, use different areas of the brain than other people when confronted with unfair choices, enabling them to make decisions rationally rather than emotionally. This was a study that came out about a year ago. It begins, if a friend or relative won $100 and then offered you a few dollars, would you accept this windfall? So they've won $100 or they've... And then they say, here's $3, here's $5, would you accept it? The logical answer would seem to be, sure, why not? But human decision-making does not always appear rational. So they did this study. They found that only about a quarter of us would say, sure, I'll accept the money. The rest would say, no, that's not fair. You've got lots of money. You're giving me $3 out of $100? That's not fair. And they may turn down the money completely. Unless they are Buddhist meditators. In which case, whether it's fair or not, more than half will take what is offered. Isn't that interesting? So it's quite a difference. It's the difference between a quarter and a half. So they did these studies, I mean, fascinating studies. They did this game where somebody had $20 and could say to somebody, to their partner, I'm going to give you $10 of my $20. Now, probably everybody, almost everybody would say, yeah, it seems fair. I'll take the $10. But what about if it's $5 or $3? You know, they found real differences. Many people, non-meditators, three quarters of them, when you reach a certain point, will say, that's not fair. I'm not accepting anything. Now you say, well, isn't that crazy? You know, why wouldn't you accept something rather than nothing? But what they've found is that a certain part of the brain gets activated. It's called the anterior insula, and it's been linked to the emotion of disgust. This gets activated in these kind of situations. And what they found is that the anterior insula activity was higher for unfair offers. So if you were offered a dollar out of $20, then for most people, this part of the brain connected with disgust would get activated. How dare you offer me a dollar out of $20? And that this, the level of activation of this part of the brain, predicted the likelihood of an offer being rejected. So if this was being fired up, the chances are that the person who's had this insula activated would likely say, no, that's outrageous that you'd offer me a dollar out of $20 or $2 out of $20. However, in meditators, the anterior insula showed no significant activation for unfair offers. So what's happening is meditators are able to uncouple the negative emotional response to an unfair offer. They say presumably by attending to internal bodily states. So rather than being activated and saying, this is outrageous, it's almost like that gets uncoupled. It's like when we get caught up in a strong emotion, being able to uncouple the bodily sensations and the thoughts from that strong story that we're caught up in. And that's really what we're doing in meditation. We're doing this uncoupling. The Buddha put it this way. He said, in the seen, let there just be the seen. In the heard, just the heard. In the understood, just the understood. That we're kind of uncoupling our experiences rather than having them all like glom together. How dare you do this? And reactivity and frustration and annoyance and all of that coming up. So this study says when assessing unfair offers, meditators seem to activate an almost entirely different network of brain areas than do the rest of folks. But both the Buddha's teachings and the neuroscience, the more recent neuroscience, says we can train our minds We can change our brains. That mindfulness and meditation are very helpful ways of training the mind, of shifting the focus of our brains, moving into the calm side of our nervous system from the fight or flight mode, activating areas of the brain associated with ease and well-being, and deactivating the areas connected with stress and anxiety. So that training the mind leads to greater happiness and well-being, less stress, and less suffering. So in this season of storms and elections, the practice of mindfulness can be a great support, helping us come back to the present moment, calming the nervous system, changing our brains, seeing the possibility of alternate courses of action that lead to greater happiness, being able to choose, because we see clearly that we have a choice in this moment. And we can open ourselves to joy, to love, to connection that can only be experienced in the present moment. And we can cultivate qualities that lead to freedom, to an end to suffering. And so I would like to encourage you to cultivate this quality of these qualities of presence, of mindfulness, of compassion, perhaps particularly in these days where there's so many things that are kind of pulling us into the fight or flight mode, to judgment, to activation, and to see that in any moment we can bring awareness to our experience and we can find a way out of suffering.